That's Gene Ammons on tenor sax, leading his horn section, including Art Farmer on trumpet and Jackie McLean on alto sax, in one of the great studio jam sessions titled Happy Blues. Sounds like an anomaly, doesn't it? Happy Blues. It's the title track from his 1956 album, also featuring Duke Jordan on piano, Addison Farmer on bass, Art Taylor on drums, and Candido Camero on congas. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and all week going into Friday, we'll be talking about those issues that made an impression on you as being very important in 2016. The impact of these issues and events, and what you think the significance of these issues and events might be. There are no right or wrong answers here. It's just talking about your understanding of issues that might have had great significance, whether people might have missed it or not. The main thing is that you believe these things to be significant. And all the more so because, of course, we're ending the year 2016. We're going into the year 2017. We've spent a lot of time talking about things, looking for clarity, because this is going to be our year of reckoning. We have to get a bit more clarity about this system that we are going to be dealing with, and more importantly, clarity about how prepared we are in terms of self-defense. You have to have some kind of self-defense as we go into the new year. And that requires a keen understanding of the system that we are governed by, or the system that we are impacted by. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Let's hear what you're thinking, and we will learn something from each other in the course of an exchange of information about these things. I think it's really important that we do some self-analysis. You know, we can't depend on the media, of course. It's not necessarily the most accurate source, but we should be able to decode for ourselves some very important things that are going to be at front and center of our lives, whether we want it or not. It's going to happen, and we are going to have to put up something of a defense for ourselves, because other systems that we are depending on are also failing in one way or the other. We can't look to political systems. They are in various stages of falling apart. And we have to have for ourselves an understanding of what it is we're dealing with. Do you have such an understanding? What stories emerged in 2016 that you think might serve as a reference point for what has happened, what is likely to continue to happen, and what we should be prepared for, and how we can prepare for it? What do we need to do? What do we need to have in our arsenal for 2017? Okay, so we'll do that. And of course, I would even open it up to your general observations as well, the way we do it on Free Your Mind Friday. You could also consider it Free Your Mind Thursday. The idea is to encourage discussion and debate. It is not just to hear what other people are thinking. You're part of the people, so let's hear what you're thinking. Let's hear what you have acquired in the way of an understanding of the system, but also an understanding of your own capacity to deal with it. What are you doing to deal with it? This is very, very important. As you know, our new administration, our new President Donald J. Trump administration, will be on board as of January the 20th. We already see where it's headed. And we have some information about what he's coming into. We have had 8 years of Barack Obama and his administration, so we should be able to talk about some of the most important things that we need to understand about that administration carrying into the new administration. But I get a sense of reticence. People are very, very afraid, and this is the worst thing you can do. You know, be on guard, but don't be afraid. We have to talk about these things because we need to summon up our courage to continue, because simply we have to continue. No matter what happens, we have to continue. So there's no point to becoming overwhelmed by the anticipation of what will happen. More than anything, we need to concentrate on our capacity to deal with it. Don't worry about them, because you know what's happening. You know what's likely to happen. Concentrate more on building the capacity to deal with it and to come out of that process relatively unscathed. We are all in this soup together. And so we have to look to ourselves, mostly. We'll have to look to ourselves to deal with whatever is coming. We should never, ever be so afraid. We should be on alert, not afraid. That's the number one weapon of the system, to have us all in a state of fear. And the fear being predicated on our own internalized view that there's nothing we can do. No. Not at all. What we should be talking about, and this is the point of reckoning that I've been talking about, we have to come to terms with how the system works. We have to spend more time understanding it. But we also have to spend more time building our capacity to deal with it. And it is not enough simply to talk about, here's a system and we're overwhelmed and the things they're going to do to us. We have to talk about what is our capacity at this moment to deal with whatever is coming down the pike and even beyond it. In the sense that the system is powerful, I mean, this shouldn't be news to us. And it shouldn't be news to us that the system misbehaves all the time. It lies, it deceives, it abuses its power, it overreaches, it blatantly disregards this notion that we are, in fact, or supposed to be, a democratic society. It is supposed to be fair and just. It's not going to be any of these things, not even with a switch, an ideological switch. Systems at their core remain, unless there's something dramatic that is about to happen, and that would come not from the system itself, it would come from the people. But you can see how, with the Obama administration coming in as a Democratic administration after a Bush administration or after any other Republican administration, there isn't very much of a difference ideologically with our political systems. Except that more and more we are seeing the cooperation. It might have always been this way, but not this emphatic. A sense of the the power elite and the corporate elite being almost one and the same. And of course, with the Trump administration, we've seen that already done. It's out there. It is not hiding it. We have an oligarchy that has taken hold of our way of life. And that is going to be a monumental shift. It had always been there, but not necessarily as pronounced, as visible. We knew it was always there. Now it has taken another step, another bold step, and said, look, we're running things. And you're not citizens of this country. You're kind of like our employees and our minions. We are in charge, and we're running the United States as a corporation. That's a shift. Well, what is our capacity, both collectively and individually? What capacity do we have to cope with this change? And it's one of those fundamental changes. Other things are attached to it, of course. But here we have a pronounced combination of wealth, of the wealthy, and the political apparatus. And it's making no apologies for its, you know, it's barreling through with all kinds of concepts except the notion that we have an organized society, organized under some kind of an idea of democracy. We know we won't have any. We will not have any democracy. We won't have any say in what's going to happen. That's been made very clear. So we, in that sense, we have two sets of homework to do. We have to build our individual capacity to cope. We have to build an organized resistance as well, because our survival depends upon it. And by extension, in many ways, the survival of many people outside of the United States, many countries, will depend on it, that we have some kind of capacity to resist what's coming, because it will serve as the template for worldwide governance. That's what we're facing. So we don't have time to, you know, futz around and play around and be uninvolved. We have to be involved at some level, which means that we have to learn from the past. We have to learn from the past. Have we learned anything? And what is it? If you have learned something, what is it that we have learned that will serve us well in the immediate future and beyond? Heavy lessons, but you have to talk about them, because the number one thing that you have to overcome, this is the immediate work, is to not succumb to fear, not be immobilized by fear. That's the number one weapon they have, to instill fear, and by doing so, we become obedient. We let them do what they have to do because we imagine the powers to be so total, so complete, that there's nothing we can do. There is, of course, something that we can do. We have to fashion that response. And it seems to be that it's a double-edged sword. We have to work individually, and we have to work collectively. But we have to work smartly, much smarter than we have worked before, because the rules are going to be quite different. But they're going to lead to the same path, the same conclusion, but there will be different ways of enforcing those rules. And so they'll have to create new rules, new ways of arriving at the predetermined destination. So let's talk about that, and let's see if we can decipher what happened in 2016 in this regard, how we are moved along from one ideological framework to another ideological framework. The previous one, this would now be the Obama administration, might have had or might have articulated a different vision, and it might in some ways tweaked the system to make it appear that this was about being a progressive administration. There's no pretense now. There's no pretense, and there's no not even a need to pretend. They want you to know. The Trump administration wants us to know that they have taken charge of just about everything that will impact our lives. And those decisions will be enacted into law and into policy and without our resistance to them. You know, we're just going to sit there and let it happen. We have seen in the 2016 election, and we have to deal with it, we've seen a massive failure of our political system. It imploded. It caved in on itself after years of inattention and years of misbehavior, really, as the leaders of a so-called democratic society. It finally blew up. Even the alternative systems, they imploded. And by the way, we haven't heard from these alternative systems about what it is they're doing. What is the agenda for the next year? We haven't heard that at all yet. So the expectation is, in that sense, there will be more of the same. We're not going to change tactics. We're not going to change even our vision. We're not going to change anything. We'll continue as we have in previous years, which is an insufficient and an inexcusable response. So all around, we have lost a lot. We have lost a lot, and we have to rebuild, which is pitiful. But more than ever, we need to get to a point of understanding ourselves about what our political agenda is. What is the extent and capacity of our individual power? And what could be the capacity for collective power, if it is to exist at all? But there's no question that at the end of this year, 2016, we should have come to a realization that we are largely defenseless. We are not, by that I mean, not that we don't have the capacity to change things. It's that the capacity to change things has to start largely from scratch. And it will take time. And time is not something we have in abundance. It's a very serious question. So help us discuss this idea today of our individual capacity based on what we have experienced in 2016. And what we envision is likely to happen in 2017, it still comes down to the interplay between the people and the system. But what is the condition of the people to face off against the system? What is the capacity there? do we have individually an understanding of our own power? Do we have an understanding that we too, individually, we have some serious changes to make? And collectively, we have to be prepared for what's coming, and we've been given enough hints of what's coming. We can't be immobilized by fear, so then how do we construct effective resistance to what's coming? It's not a popular discussion, I know, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take a look at it. That's exactly the work that we have to do. We have to be involved in these kinds of conversations because we will have to face off with a system that is now emboldened by the absolute combination of wealth and political ultra-fascist, not ultra-fascist, but certainly fascist, fascist thought, fascist policies. It's that time has arrived. And we will have to find a way, individually and collectively, to deal with it and to come through this period that we are about to enter. We'll take this short break and come to your calls at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and we are continuing our discussion about preparing for our exit from 2016 and our entry into 2017, knowing that there are enormous challenges that we have to face, and we should face them intelligently, but that comes after a reckoning. From Florida, Buzz, you're on the air.
How are you? I have to say that I think you're a little bit too optimistic, and I'm going to say why. About
optimistic.
Our capacity to do something. I'm 74 years old. The last time I saw the public alter the course of activities of our government, our fascist government in Washington, when the peace marches in Washington back in the 60s. That's the last time that I think that, and maybe the only time in my lifetime, that the public actually caused a change in the program of the politicians, the president, and the rest of the people down there. And I don't really see how. And by the way, I don't know who orchestrated those peace marches. Who got them? Who was the catalyst that got them going? It certainly didn't happen in Iraq when we invaded that country twice and destroyed it, and Libya, et cetera, et cetera. You see where I'm going? It just doesn't happen.
Well, let's deal with the premise. What do you think was in existence at that time that caused this coalescence that is absent now?
Well, I think that there's the people feel the same as they did back then. Only the difference is that a lot of bodies were coming home, and it caused a lot of concern in that respect. And that's a mild way of saying that. You know, it was a very depressing era in the 60s. Because of the Vietnam War.
So it was depressing, but it also was, I think, encouraging, because you saw people hurdling over these obstacles that had prevented people from getting together against policies that were just wrong.
That's true. No question about that. It's very difficult. There's so many things that we can discuss, and I don't want to take up all your time. But yeah, that's true. If you look at it that way, it was remarkable that so many people materialized in D.C. and to protest the war. And it was reported someplace where both Nixon and his predecessor Johnson were petrified to see 500,000 people outside, and knowing that they could possibly break down the fence and get into the White House, and they were there some of the time that these people were there. So, you know, I don't know how that came about.
It was the will
of the people to do so.
It was the will of the people, but
how was it orchestrated? I don't know that.
I think it was also, and I don't think you would disagree, it was also that you had a leadership that was relevant and involved, and that basically reflected the strength and the will of the people as messengers to the people about getting involved and getting active in keeping the system in check on this issue of the Vietnam War. Now, it also spilled over. It was the late civil rights movement that also got other things done, other work done. But you had a very strong bond between leadership, and it was a people-driven leadership, and you had the causes for which they were fighting absolutely relevant to those same people. And they were clear that the enemy was the government.
Yes.
They were very clear about that.
Let me ask you this, Latrice. Who, you say the leadership, I know who the leadership was in the civil rights activity. We all know that, pretty much Martin Luther King. He was a standout guy. And of course, he spoke out against the war, as a lot of people did. But who do you think was composed the leadership back then? I mean, this is off the issue, but who were these people? I don't know if it was Abby Hoffman or, you know, I remember some of the names, but the bottom line is, though, Latrice, said, I don't see it happening today. And I don't know I don't think that the public has been pushed back enough to react. As bad as things are, they're still relatively good, if you don't mind my saying that. Not for a lot of people, but their quiet desperation type syndrome has taken over.
Well, yeah, I think you're right.
People
are
not willing to stand up and be counted. And you're pleading. I don't say you're pleading, but you're asking or suggesting that. But I'm not pessimistic. I'm sort of realistic. I don't think that's in the cards yet. You know, you make me feel badly because you say, well, and all your listeners who say, well, you should be out there doing something. That's essentially what you're saying.
No, what I'm saying is you should be thinking really hard. That's the first thing I'm saying. Think really, really carefully and think really, really hard and come to a point of reckoning. That's my point. So you're not disillusioned about leadership. You're not, just because somebody's in the position of leadership, as I just said, we saw alternative political movements literally implode because they failed in a way, we have to admit it. They failed to understand how to build capacity and how the system works and how to encourage people to be involved. So my point is that the work is individual first, Now, we can't just blindly jump into a movement. We have to first come to some conclusions for ourselves.
I think you and I are there, and probably 98% of your listeners are there. But there are a lot of people who I've gone to political meetings where they take direction from the top and not offer information or ideas from the bottom, the rank and file, the people that are actually in the room. Are being dictated to by some person who says, well, this is what we have to do. And that's how you wound up with Clinton and Trump, is because there was no, it didn't come from, what do they say? I don't like these terms, these hackneyed terms, grassroots, but it doesn't come from the bottom up, it comes from the top down. Somebody someplace or some group of people someplace decided that Clinton was going to be a Democrat, and somehow Trump got in there because of all the other people that were running. And I don't understand. I mean, I see what's going on, but I don't understand it. How the public goes along with this. If you stand up at a meeting and say something and say, "Look, this Clinton person is not good for us," you get booed. You know, you just can't do it. So I understand your, and I agree with you, your position, but maybe somebody else has some better ideas than I do. I'm sure they do.
Well, I like your ideas. I'll tell you that. And I agree with them. We have, as a so-called progressive community, we have deferred this essential piece of work, which is to evaluate how our counter systems have worked or not worked, what is worth holding on to and what is to be changed. And for your own self, you have to set a standard of what would appeal to you and where you jump into the fray based on the compatibility between your political idea and what is being sold as a political solution.
Okay.
And you should absolutely do that piece of work first. We cannot avoid it.
Let me just say this one. This is another facet of this. There comes a time when you feel that is it worth you donating my personal life to any causes when it almost seems like the results will be fruitless. So am I supposed to give up my personal affairs, my family, my this, that? And I've been politically active locally for over 25 years, and I got a few things accomplished. But if I look back at all the time that I spent and all the fretting that I had to go through, I wonder if it was worth it. And I just want to add this. I know a very prominent attorney, you wouldn't know him, but he's a prominent, very successful attorney in New York City. And I talked to him, and 2 months ago, he said, well, he just told me that 2 months ago, he stopped reading the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. He's devoting he's working on a project, a charitable thing, and he's devoting his time to his life and his personal interests, and not paying attention to what's going on. And I see the value in that because he's got his life. And maybe a lot of people are already doing this, and that's why we're in the shape that we're in. I don't know. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for getting us started. And with such very clear a clear picture that you have arrived at, even though you're struggling with it, but I think it is a very worthwhile struggle to think, spend some time thinking and assessing things. And that's in itself a very important piece of political work. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you.
Thanks. Westchester, Nasi, you're on the air.
How are you doing, Rajesh?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
All right. I think that the people, the American people, especially the so-called poor and so forth and so on, we're not dealing with trying to be self-sufficient in this capitalist society. We're just spending, even if they don't even have the money, they're spending. And everybody's, with all the cell phones and all of these things, they're just some type of aspirin, to keep people down. You can get up early in the morning and they're walking across a dark street looking at the cell phone, almost getting hit by cars. So that I think the self-sufficiency is the crux in America. Castro pushed self-sufficiency, and they hated it. They hate somebody being self-sufficient. They want you to always buy, buy, buy. And we're caught up in all of this. And that's why we don't have time. We don't have time to read, so forth and so on. I'll say, take African American. If you're talking to say somebody who's a woman is going to she wants to be a singer or she wants to be a jazz singer, and you say, Sarah Vaughan? And they don't know who you're talking about. That's how we've been culturally assassinated, and they're constantly doing that, culturally assassinating us where we don't even lead in the things that we can do. That's just one thing. Our housing, we should make up our own housing, not follow somebody else. Something that is sufficient for us to live in. As poor people, whoever you are, African American, Caucasian, doesn't matter, because there's poor people all the way across the board, and where you can live in it. You don't need to go by the high ranch and all of that kind of stuff. You can construct that for your needs, not for everything legislated for the legislate you right out of the deal. And right here and all in Westchester, they're just gobbling up every piece of land they can. Your kids won't even never have a place to play in the woods or anything anymore, because there's not going to be any of it left. And then as far as the political thing, the pipeline came right through here, and it's going right past Count Edison and Indian Point. And the governor just said, I'm not for that. But he never did a thing about it. So he doesn't care. From the top down, yet they do not care about the people who are on the bottom. And that's all I have to say for today.
Not yet. you offered a bunch of things. We have to now proceed to dissect. Well, first of all, I have to ask, is this a surprise to you that government...
No.
Will tend to behave in a particular way, and that people conditioned by government will also predictably behave in a particular way. They would accept denial of their rights. They would accept uneven treatment. They would accept undemocratic rule. This is normal. But it is normal as long as there isn't a cogent response to it. There's no way a governor can hold this as so-called policy unless people accept it. Because the governor has the will and the organization and we use this word all the time. He has the system on his side, and he can enforce it. The thing is, government still, as powerful as it is, they can't forever fight off the will of people if the people are organized. We simply are not organized. And we don't put that as a major, major task to organize ourselves and our communities. Our communities are completely disorganized.
Right.
We have on practically every level, we have no way of putting up a resistance and putting up a fight. And if we do, it is sporadic. You know, somebody gets shot, we have a big march. Some major thing has happened that people that really riles the people up, they will be riled up, but the system knows they're not going to sustain that effort over even a 3-month period or a 4-month period. It will eventually die down, and they have the means also to crush it. So it still comes back to the question that government, the interplay between government and the people, is supposed to be bilateral. The people are supposed to have the power to flex their muscle and get things done that benefit the community as a whole. But they're not on the job. They're not organized. And it's because it's the easier way out. So what do you say to that? What has to happen to build a resistance that is effective? And by that I mean, how do you build organization, and how do you, the very thing you started out with about people are more into their cell phones, even if they're crossing the road and not paying attention to the fact that there's an oncoming bus or a truck. It happens to be an extraordinarily relevant way of putting the issue at hand. We are concerned about things that really have nothing to do with our power. And yet we expect the system of power to respect the power we don't exert. That's a big anomaly, isn't it?
In the Hudson, and you know, you bring up something before about the slave trade in Yonkers, and I'm not too far from Yonkers.
Yes,
that kind of blew my mind. But the whole thing is, from Yonkers all the way up to Poughkeepsie, the African American has been wiped out either by urban renewal for the last 16 years, and people have left here. That don't mean they went to somewhere else and it was better. They just left here on account of the standard, the high price of living, and so forth and so on. Those places where this is the area right where I'm at is where they wanted to lynch Paul Robeson. The average person that comes here doesn't even know nothing about it. I don't care if he's from Africa. I had to tell guys from Africa, what are you talking about? What are you here for? I said, this is where they wanted to kill Paul Robeson, who was going all over the world about peace and justice, but you don't know anything about it. I don't like people to be in my midst and they don't know anything about the native people, the Indians and the African Americans and other Puerto Ricans who came here and built stuff, but then now they have to leave. That's what's going on, and so they're right there by on the Major Deacon, there used to be these buildings there where they painted flowers and everything in the windows, so the people from the Westchester wouldn't be bothered, wouldn't worry them when they went past it. And that's how they keep it. They keep that same mentality, and we don't want to hurt ourselves. We don't want to be worried about those people who don't have. I can't even put it in the right words. That's the situation. And the average person in this society, he doesn't understand that he has a racial mentality that keeps that system going. Because if you told him the real truth about the situation that African Americans and Native Americans went through, they can't handle it. They got to go get some gin or something because they can't handle it. But we're supposed to handle all of this nonsense, but they can't handle even the truth. That's the bottom line.
But this is true. However, it does not come close to addressing the fact that we, the people themselves, have abrogated our duty to ourselves and to our future. We've just walked away from it. We have not pushed ourselves to protect the turf we've won. And in some cases, we don't care. We don't care. You could talk, Paul, and preach Saul to many, many people in those same communities. And you can try to convince them of the advantages of fighting for what they have. It is not going to hit home. Only a few people will listen. And that's part of the science of oppression. You programmed against fighting for your interests because you are depleted of your own identity, your capacity to think, and all of these things they're all in the mix of oppression. So it is not surprising for those people who can organize that this is part of organizing. You have to expect it would be as hard as climbing Mount Everest in 6-inch heels backwards. You know, it's just not going to work. You have to expect that this is part of the territory, but it doesn't mean that you give up and you walk away when you have an opportunity and when there's a possibility of organizing in order to attain those things that you think accrue to you by virtue of history and so forth. Why do you walk away? Why do you neglect? You look at Harlem. Harlem was the mecca of black political power in the United States. But it was just the people neglected to take care of what they had. And they neglected to hold their leaders accountable. And this is why we have the Harlem of today, which is a figment of its own imagination. It's nothing like it used to be. When my aunt left Trinidad at the turn of the century,
right,
Harlem was where she was going. Harlem was where she went. Harlem allowed her to start a business. She had a beauty parlor. She was a deeply religious woman. She started a church. She was employed by the post office. And she seldom ventured outside of Harlem to get her business done. Everything she needed was right there. She purchased a brownstone. So it wasn't that Harlem lacked the capacity to sustain life. It was that people decided not to pay attention to it and safeguard Harlem. It fell apart, including the, you know, Harlem, by the way, produced the largest share of black elected officials in the state of New York, including... Harlem produced a state comptroller, that's Carl McCall. It produced a lieutenant governor, Basil Patterson, who was also a deputy mayor. It produced a state senator who became mayor, that was David Dinkins. It produced the fourth most powerful member of Congress, Charles Rangel, who is going to be retiring after 40 years. And nowhere, if you put them all together, could you see the relationship with all of that political power and the absolute destruction of Harlem. See, they don't relate to each other, again, because the power structure fully owned these politicians. It did not own Adam Clayton Powell, but we have had no Adam Clayton Powells in several decades coming out of Harlem.
Right.
And the people seem to be okay with it. So it disintegrated. So this is part of the reckoning that has to happen. It has to be a reckoning on a community level, on an individual level, that this is not going to be allowed. And we won't tolerate it. See? So we have this work to do. And it's not really about affiliation with any political party. The Democrats do it, the Republicans do it. It's about working in your interests and exercising as much power as possible over that process. I'm so glad you called and put these ideas out there so that we can begin again to build on them. But your ideas and what you've offered today are deeply rooted in the reality that we have been experiencing for a long time, but not paid attention to it. So I thank you for returning us to that central issue, our responsibility to our own interests and our own future. Thanks so much. From San Francisco, Jesse, you're on the air.
So glad to talk to you, and the subject is really interesting. I wanted to maybe just make the theme based on what I would call the good, the bad, and the empty.
Okay.
So I'll start off with the good. The last few callers really brought up an important emotion that is, you know, it's always there, and in some ways it's kind of worse than ever. But I'll start off with the good. Well, maybe I'll start off with a little bit of the bad. So, you know, one way beyond the political analysis, which is sometimes hard to judge objectively, is maybe the environmental analysis. So in terms of the bad, yeah, I'll start off here. In terms of the environment, yeah, I would say objectively we could determine that the status of the planet, the status of the living systems of the people is worse now than ever. We have a greater rate of extinction, or at least a high rate of extinction, and further along, looks like, you know, the great apes of Africa are on the verge, the cheetahs on the verge, and so forth. And there's so many indicators. I know that you're aware of many of them. I imagine many of the listeners are aware of them. So that's one thing to look at. Then when you look at the political system, you're right. We, in a sense, we were duped seven times over this election. And if it was an election, you talked about world government. Maybe it's that much further along. We don't have overt tyranny. You go back, you know, a couple hundred years when we had overt slavery and so forth. It isn't that. It's covert. It maybe in some ways it's worse than ever, but it's not overt, which is at least the difference. At least they have to pretend to be hiding it, although maybe now they're grinning and mocking in our face that they have us. But on the positives, I mean, this is stuff that I also have to focus on in terms of technological solutions. We're looking at in the next few years a reduction of pollutants, whether it's for climate change or just for the air that we breathe, for our health, with the rise of solar and wind and electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles, these are going to change the air that we breathe. So that should be a real benefit. The understanding and the information age has allowed us to see real solutions. Whether or not they're being implemented, that's the next question. But we now have the ability to do mass-scale permaculture and other forms of organic farming so that we don't have to have GMOs and pesticides. So basically we have the tools already and in place, and people know about them more and more. So that is, in a sense, you could say that's under the surface. The rise of Bernie's campaign is evidence that people are wanting solutions and know about the solutions. And yet, as you are also talking about, there's this overwhelming futility that arises and fear that arises. People are afraid to even try. Often they're told that it's a fait accompli, and, you know, don't even point to the the powers that be, or you'll be in trouble. Just go along with the fascist system. And so you have this dichotomy, and it seems what I'm starting to feel is that it's always been like this. You've always had these feelings of hope and whatever the opposite of hope is. I don't know if it would be despair, I guess. And then,
but
from,
you know, Jesse,
yeah.
We are continuing to repeat and hold on to systems
right.
that do not work.
Right. Well, so then
they,
I want
they're,
to go
they're not
the
yielding
third.
Results, and we still are kidding ourselves into thinking that we're accomplishing something. No, there has to be a very different approach. The previous approaches have not worked. And, for example, you know, back in the 1980s.
Well, if I may just put in the third tenet, maybe is one of the keys to this. And the third tenet is the empty. So the empty, and maybe this sounds aloof, but I don't think it is aloof. I think it's very serious, and I think it's a key element. And that is, and this is coming from a Buddhist perspective, so if we all have been here before, and light, and there is, in a sense, a karma to all of our individual lives and then also collective lives, then part of our purpose on Earth, people might say it's futile, but you know what? We were put on this. It is a test. If this, what is that saying? You know, if this was an actual life, you would have been given instructions at the beginning. Well, what if this is all a test? So we're put on this. We're put on this Earth, or we've jumped into to this Earth to feel the Earth, to make our merit, to avoid evil, to do good, and to purify our mind. And
well thank
and that
you.
That means that yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much. We've come to the end of the program, and and you have the great privilege. We have the great privilege of going out with some very, very sage words from you. So thank you so much for that. Stay tuned. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is next. We will continue the discussion, and it is important for us to do this. We have to face some ugly truths about progressive movements and about movements in general, but we always have to remember that we owe it to ourselves to do so. We have to do this. Thanks a lot. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.